Let's take our Bibles tonight, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Tonight we have come to the end, Solomon's final word. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. The conclusion, he says, the conclusion, the final word when all has been heard is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every man. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. A lot of songs have been written from the book of Ecclesiastes based on it and based on its thoughts. A few songs capture the spirit of Ecclesiastes better than the song Dust in the Wind by Kerry Livgren and the group Kansas. You're probably familiar with the lyrics, maybe, maybe not. They go like this. I close my eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity. Dust in the wind, all they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind. Don't hang on, nothing lasts forever but the earth and sky. It slips away and all your money won't another minute buy. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind. Now, I can't prove it, but I suspect that Kerry Livgren, who later became a Christian, as some of you probably know, was probably reading Ecclesiastes when he wrote that song. Because if you had opened it to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, Solomon says this, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, is all is emptiness, meaninglessness, purposeless. What advantage does a man have in all of his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Vanity of vanities or dust in the wind. And the message is the same. Life in a Genesis 3, sin-cursed world, well, it is futile. It is frustrating and it is mysterious. It's futile because at the fall, God removed, according to Ecclesiastes 2, your ability to be fully satisfied with life. It's frustrating because there's something within you that whispers that the pain and the suffering and the death of this life are just wrong. Things are simply not as they should be under the sun. And we know it. We know that things are not the way they should be, but we're powerless to change it. What is bent, as Solomon says, it cannot be straightened. And besides the feelings of futility and emptiness, life, according to Ecclesiastes, is also incomprehensible. God has a perfect master plan for everything. Solomon is very clear on that. But God refuses to give you a peek at his schedule. As one commentator said, God holds the key, but he's not loaning it out to anyone. And the truth is, futility and mystery do dominate life under the sun. And so in Ecclesiastes, Solomon went on a search to overcome those things. He, for one, would not rest until he discovered the meaning and purpose of life. He had to find lasting joy and contentment. It had to be somewhere under the sun. But to his dismay, Solomon discovered that the meaning and purpose of life could not be found in pleasure-seeking, in kingdom-building, or in intellectual pursuits. Even though he had reached the pinnacle of all three of those. Oh, he found a temporary satisfaction. It lasted for a moment, it lasted for a day, for a week. He was happy for a little bit with those things, but then all the water drained out of the sieve. Chapter 2, he said this, verse 9. He says, then I became great, and I increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all of my labor, and this was my reward for all of my labor. And if you stop there, you say, well, he found it. Thus I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, it was vanity and striving after the wind, shepherding the wind, literally. There was no profit under the sun. The pleasure of the highest successes attainable didn't satiate Solomon's hungry soul. In the end, when he had built his bigger buildings, all their size did was magnify the echoes of emptiness. They really just made life seem more lonely, more vain. When Solomon laughed and partied all night, in the morning he was left with only a grand sense of uselessness and despair. Champagne bubbles, so they made delight for a moment, but you know, they just don't have the strength to sustain for a lifetime, do they? The more stunning Solomon's successes, the more frustrated he became. Chapter 2, verse 15. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Solomon's, of course, at the top of the heap when it comes to intellect. 2, verse 15. As the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then? Why have I bothered? Why have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is emptiness, like a little steam off the top of a cup of coffee. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life. I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and shepherding the winds. One day, for all of his intellectual achievements, Solomon would be too feeble physically and mentally to ascend the stairs of the Tower of Learning. Then where would he be? Well, his ivory tower of academic success would become a coffin, and all his achievements would be meaningless. You see, death didn't just haunt Solomon in this book, it hunted him. No matter how grand his successes, standing just beyond them all was the merciless specter of death, its bony finger crooked, saying, come. Solomon found that no matter what you accomplish, in the end, death steals it. Death kills meaning under the sun. In other words, Solomon's search for meaning and purpose was really an abject failure. Chapter 2, verse 20. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind, all we are is just dust in the wind. See, everywhere Solomon looked under the sun, he saw an arid desert. He saw a desert that was barren of contentment, barren of satisfaction, barren of lasting meaning. Money? Forget it. It meant nothing. He had more than anybody, and he still couldn't buy what was really important. Satisfaction. Well, thankfully, at the end of chapter 2, we found that Solomon's search had been fruitless because he was looking in the wrong place. Chapter 2, verse 25 said this, "For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him, without God?" At the fall, it's very simple. At the fall, when Adam sinned, part of the curse was simply this. God extracted from the human race the ability to be satisfied. As I said, it's the only thing Mick Jagger has ever got right. God cursed men and women in such a way that they would be on an endless search for contentment, on an endless search for the meaning of life. And they would always be driven by this restless urge deep within them, longing to be satisfied. But you know what? They would find in this world that satisfaction is like a mirage in the desert. It appears on the horizon. There it is. If you just run a little faster, a little farther, you'll get to the satisfaction you long for. It's an oasis of rest and happiness. But you know what? You never quite reach it. You get there and it turns into sand and dust too. It just fades away as you come up to it. Relentlessly driven, then, men and women leave no stone unturned to try to find lasting joy and enduring peace. But Solomon could tell them, the search will come to nothing until you come to God. Now, as he brings this masterful book to a close in chapter 12, Solomon returns to that theme that he first expounded for us in chapter 2. You remember in chapter 12, verse 1, it began with these words, "Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth." This is where your attention must focus. This is where everything that you long for and desire will be found. And then he concludes with verse 13 and 14. The conclusion, the final word. When all has been heard, fear God. Keep his commandments, because this applies to every man. For God will bring every act to judgment and everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Now, as we start to look at verses 13 and 14, let me just point out to you quickly that it's widely accepted among scholars that verses 13 and 14 were added after the original author laid down his pen. The argument is that, well, these commands, they diverge too widely from the rest of the book. They're just too conventional, too establishment to be this author's. I reject that view completely. All the existing texts of Ecclesiastes have these verses in them, and so we can't just arbitrarily subtract them. And the truth is, they actually do fit with the book. And they fit in a masterful, marvelous way. In fact, without these two verses on the end, the book of Ecclesiastes would be useless. This makes the book right here. So, as we dig into these two verses, we're going to find that they contain two commands and then two reasons to keep the commands. Two commands and two reasons. They are Solomon's profound final word. Let's start with the commands, verse 13. The conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments. Solomon says, when you have searched the creation from the top to the bottom, when you have discussed and dialogued and argued over every point of learning you could possibly argue over, when you have analyzed every pain, every sorrow, every joy, every delight in human existence, you're going to arrive at this place. Fear God and keep his commandments. Now, Solomon could have said that at the beginning and saved us a lot of pain, couldn't he? I mean, how many times has he killed us and had to resurrect us in this book? How long has he held us underwater until we thought our lungs and brains would burst, right, only to then pull us up just as we were dying to rescue us and give us a right perspective? It would have been so much easier if he would have just said this right at the beginning. Would you have listened if he had? If he had said this right at the beginning, you would have said, oh, same old, yada, yada, you know, fear God, obey God. The Bible always says that. If this had been the first verse in the Bible, you would hardly, or in the first verse in Ecclesiastes, you would hardly even have glanced at it. But by now, by this point in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has your attention. In fact, rivet guns couldn't fasten you more firmly to this text. After 12 chapters of searching, defeat, and disillusionment, and death, Solomon comes up with this? Fear God and keep his commandments? I mean, we know that Solomon hates pat answers. Solomon eats naive little views of life for lunch. He is so theologically incorrect that some of the old Jews wanted to throw him out of the canon. Fear God? Obey God? That is so theologically clean, it squeaks. And why does Solomon the rebel draw everything together like that? Well, let's see if we can find an answer. First, let me give you the interpretation of the two commands. The interpretation, that's not hard. They're two of the most common imperatives in the whole Testament. In the original, Solomon flipped the normal word order, putting the object first for emphasis, so it actually says, God you fear, his commandments you keep. It's emphatic. Nonetheless, this is so typically Old Testament, it sounds like something from Deuteronomy, doesn't it? Well, to fear God, that just meant basically to live in complete devotion to God. It speaks of the awe-inspired inner tumult that you, a finite creature, would feel when you are confronted by your infinite creator. Woe is me, for I am ruined. You'd be hard-pressed to do better than Isaiah's words. In fact, the fear of the Lord is so struck down by the reality of the majesty and the grandeur and the glory of God that disobedience then really becomes unthinkable. Back to Isaiah, here I am, Lord, send me? I mean, to do anything but spring into action when that voice speaks, when God's voice speaks, to do anything but to obey is simply unimaginable. So Solomon says the final word here, guys, is fear God and keep his commandments. The first command is really in part then fulfilled by the second, isn't it? You fear God by obeying him. What God has written in his word, you do. Now, as I pointed out to you, some argue that, well, this doesn't really fit the rest of Ecclesiastes. Well, I suggest to you it's actually a fantastic way to end the book. Just think about it for a moment. Chapter 1. Even if everything does seem vain and without a conclusion, those circles, the wind goes in a circle, the sun rises, the sun sets, and there's no end, no meaning, no purpose to anything. Even if at times in a sin-cursed world things do feel futile and like they're useless, the one thing you need to keep doing is obey God. Because of the fall, things are going to feel like that. Sometimes they're going to feel like that. But you can obey God in the midst of that. Or chapter 2. Fear God, putting him at the center of life. Don't senselessly seek fulfillment in the empty rain barrels of pleasure or success. Put God at the center of life. He is pleasure. Chapter 3. Well, sometimes, in fact, many times, life won't make sense. There's times when we're kind of on top of the bull, like in a rodeo, but there's other times when you feel like you're underneath the bull and it's trampling you, right? You desperately want to know what's going on. Why is this happening to me, God? What in the world are you doing in my life right now? But you know what? God doesn't send emails to explain. And in fact, he won't tell you what's going to happen in the future either. Solomon says, when life is incomprehensible, and it will be at times, Job, the one thing that you can do and must do is keep obeying him. What a beautiful stability that brings to life. Whatever God does, I know what I must do. Fear him and obey him. He will make everything beautiful in its time. Chapter 3, verse 11. Or how about chapter 5? Rather than question, berate, and blast God with angry demands when we can't get what we want, well, when you can't make sense of it all, rather than blast God, fear him and obey him. Let him reign. Let him be sovereign. He's not going to give up the throne anytime soon, so stop trying to get it. And you know what? Not only is he sovereign, he's good. He's wise. None more so. We'll let him stay on the throne. You see, and so it goes throughout the book. Amidst all the futility and the frustration of the curse, you remember in chapter 1, verse 13, it says that he talks about the difficulty and the trial and the travail that God has given to the sons of men, our translations read, but that's not what the Hebrew says, that God has given to the sons of Ha-Adam, the Adam. We are sons of the Adam, the man. Which man is that? It's the one that sinned. And that's why life is hard. And so Solomon says, amidst the futility and the frustration of the curse and through all the enigmas and mysteries of life, that God understands them. Your God, the true God, this God that you are to fear, he understands what you don't. And so there's one thing that stays constant in the midst of all of that. Obey him and fear him. Whatever's going on out here, you just obey and you fear. You say, but I don't see how things are going to work out in my life. I don't see. Yes, just keep obeying. We do, when things get really tough, the right next thing. Sorry, the next right thing. Let me say it right. When things get really, really tough in life, you do the next right thing. Sufficient is the trouble for the day. Don't worry about tomorrow. Just do the right thing today. Obey God and fear God. No matter how furiously you fume or antagonistic against God, you know, you're not going to change God's plan. It's just not going to happen. And so what you should do is obey and lovingly fear him. Now, you thought Solomon was a doubter, a skeptic, a nihilist, a cynic. But once he has convinced you of the futility and the frustration of life under the curse, that's the key to understanding this book. Solomon is looking at life under the curse. Once you understand that frustration and futility and the mystery of all that, then he can give you the answer, an obedient fear of the Lord kind of faith. He held the answer behind his back to begin with, because he knew that you were too familiar with it. If you saw it too soon, you would mock it, you would call it simplistic, you might even ignore it. Familiarity breeds contempt. Now, however, having been dragged across the broken glass and the burning coals of this book, when life feels empty, when you don't know what in the world God is doing, when death is beckoning, what brings an unshakable security, stability, and satisfaction is God, fearing him and obeying him. That is an ark in which you can ride out the hurricane or the flood of this fallen world. No waves can swamp it. No winds can capsize it. A steady, studied preoccupation with God and obeying God's word through Jesus Christ. There is no stability like that. You see, Solomon has been headed to this port all along. Verses 13 and 14. He's been headed to this harbor all along. It's where all the wisdom books eventually drop their anchor, and Ecclesiastes is one more wisdom book. It's no different. Even though it seemed like the wind was blowing us on a different course and in different directions at times, Solomon regularly took sightings on this truth. He knew where he was going. Chapter 2, verse 25, who can eat and have enjoyment without God? 3:11, God will make everything beautiful in its time. 5:7, for in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather, fear God. I know, 8:12, it will be well for those who fear God. And 12:1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. This is where he's been going all along. The conclusion, the final word, once you understand that we live in a sin-cursed world and you're disillusioned with that world enough to run to God and cling to God in our age, this side of the cross, through Jesus Christ, the conclusion, the final word is fear God and keep his commandments. That's where he was going all along. When you face an incomprehensible world, with far too much pain. Is there too much pain in this world? Okay, let's try that again. Is there too much pain in this world? Yeah, there is. There is. Far too much pain. Far too much evil. Far too much death. And there's only one thing that will keep you from losing your mind. The joyful strength found in the fear of the Lord. What did Proverbs say? The fear of the Lord is a strong tower. And those who run to it will be safe. And the proof of your fear of the Lord faith is obedience. When you sit with Job on the ash heap, the fear of the Lord faith is the one thing that will carry you through. So keep obeying. Keep fearing God. You know that God will handle his end of things. Has he ever faltered? Has he ever fallen down? Has God ever dropped the ball? He'll handle his side of things. He always has, he always will. Fearing God and keeping his commandments is a lifeline then in the stormy chaos of a fallen, sin-cursed world. So, those are the two commands. The two commands, fear God, keep his commandments. It's where Solomon was going all along. Now, he also gives us two reasons to keep those commands. At the end of verse 13, Solomon gives you the first reason to fear God and keep his commandments. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the final word because this applies to every person or every man, says the New American Standard. Unfortunately, most of our translations dull the razor-sharp knife of Solomon's statement, and they do that by inserting words. They do that by putting some words, and most of them have in italics or whatever. We need to actually throw those words out. The New King James is by far the best. Let me give you its translation. The New King James says this, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. This is what it's all about. You see, in four little Hebrew words, Solomon's answer goes from pat to profound. What is he searching for in the opening chapters of this book? He wanted meaning, he wanted purpose, he wanted satisfaction and contentment. There had to be something that tied all of life together. You know, the physicists, they're in the scientific realm, they're looking for what is that one underlying principle that ties it all together? God. Solomon is looking at it in a little bit different realm, but he's looking for the same thing. All the shoelaces of life have to be able to be tied up into a bow. There's got to be some great unifying sense-making principle. But under every rock, he found only emptiness, and behind every tree, he found only meaninglessness. And you know, he looked behind every tree in the forest, but every answer that he found there was a non-answer. Every path that he took seemed to be promising at first, but eventually it too faded out into nothing and left him lost and bewildered. He needed something that tied it all together. Pleasure? It left him apathetic. Success? Just lost its thrill. Solomon felt like a hamster in a wheel, running, 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 but getting nowhere. And no matter how fast he ran, every time he looked over his shoulder, death was catching up. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt the frustration and the emptiness and the meaninglessness of life? That I'm trying and trying and trying. Who's going to really remember the hard work that I do in my job? Really? Who's ever going to remember all the times I cleaned the house and cooked the meals? And you know? Really? All your efforts, they'll be forgotten. Everything you gain, everything you earn, everything you grasp will eventually slip from your hands in the cold hour of death. And like billions of others in the history of our human race, you too will pass like dust in the wind. Now, we usually think those are our worst moments. Solomon looks you in the eye and says, those are your best moments. Those are the moments of your greatest honesty and your greatest insight. They are your keenest glance, your clearest vision. If there is nothing else except what is here under the sun, then that would be true, wouldn't it? Because if this is all there is, then kill me quick, said Solomon. And he's right. The pain of life, the sorrow of death, would drive a stake of despair through the heart of hope. If this is all there is. But, says Solomon, when you're looking for the one thing to make sense of it all, you're trying to tie all the shoelaces up together in some kind of package, all the threads of the tapestry. When you're trying to make sense of it all, when you're desperately, desperately searching for something that will bring lasting joy and contentment, when you would sell your soul for enduring satisfaction, you will exhaust all of your options under the sun and you will be left empty and broken by the search. You're looking in the wrong place. Well, that's wrong. You're looking in the wrong person. And let's capitalize it, shall we? Fear God and keep his commandments. Why? For this is man's all. This is the thing that ties it all together. Where does it all come together? Where does it all make sense? Not with one more hollow success or one more empty pleasure. The all of man is not success. It is not pleasure. It's God. Romans 11:36. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. This is true. God is the all. He's the thing that ties it all together. And so if we translate this verse rightly, it actually makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? Fear God and keep his commandments, because this is man's all. From him and through him and to him are all things. I said this earlier in our series. Ecclesiastes teaches us something very profound about the fall, something about the wisdom and the graciousness of God. It teaches us that the curse of Genesis 3 is a severe mercy. Now, the severe part of it we get, we understand that. It's severe because it forces you to search everywhere, and everywhere you are disappointed. And then at the end of your search, you die. Dust to dust. Right? It's severe. But it's mercy, because what does it do? The curse drives you and me relentlessly back to God. It drives us to Jesus Christ. The curse is what makes you search for Christ. As God does his drawing work, what he's using to do that is your frustration with you, your sin, the sin around you, the emptiness and the meaninglessness of life. The curse is a severe mercy, driving you back to the God that we turned our backs on in the garden. Jesus is the way to God. Of course, we understand that. He is the truth that you long for. He is the life that death cannot steal. See, I don't know where you're looking for meaning and satisfaction in life. Wherever it is, stop. Just stop. You only find it when you remember your Creator through our beloved Lord Jesus Christ. He's the one who made you. It's simple, really. Devoted service and obedience to him is your all. It's the thing that explains everything. It's what you were made for. Stop fighting it. Lose yourself in it. The final word is God is your all. Now, that should be enough for any one text. But Solomon's not done. He's not done. He's got one more bullet in the gun. One more bullet, and he's not the kind of guy to let good ammunition go to waste. And so besides the fact that God is your all, fear God, obey his commandments, because this is man's all. Besides that, he's going to give you a second reason to keep his commandments. The final word, when all has been heard, fear God, keep his commandments. This is man's all. Four, explanation. God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Verse 14 is perhaps the most amazing verse in this whole book of amazing verses. There is a simple and clear and obvious application of this, but I think Solomon means much more. And so I'm going to take you through both, okay? Just a simple reading of the text is enough to strike fear in the boldest heart. Unless you know, Romans 8:1, that there is no, count it, zero, no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, this verse should make you cower and cringe. If you are not inside the circle of Jesus Christ, if you are not safe there in the unchanging, immutable, flawless righteousness of Christ, if you're not there, then be scared. Why? Because God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. God will judge the known. He will judge the secret. He will judge the public deed. He will judge the hidden thoughts. Nothing, absolutely nothing, will escape his searching justice, his powerful, holy retribution. That's motivation. That's motivation. As believers in Jesus Christ, we take a deep breath and say, praise be to God that we are inside the circle of Christ's saving work. We are safe. There is no condemnation. But you know, there's so much more to what Solomon is doing in this. And you say, well, how so? When I read verse 14, what did you think of? Where did your mind go? God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Where did your mind go? What event did your mind go to? Well, if you're thinking biblically at all, your mind probably flitted ahead to Christ's return and the end of the age and the Bema Seat judgment for believers on one hand and the Great White Throne judgment for unbelievers on the other. Do you think that's where Solomon's mind went? Uh-oh. That's New Testament revelation. And there's a fairly important little hermeneutical principle called progressive revelation, which means in the New Testament era, we know more than they knew, right? Because God has given out more information, that's all. And so it's always a mistake to read later revelation back into earlier revelation as if they knew all that we know. Progressive revelation. It's kind of like a detective reconstructing a crime. You got to keep the sequence of events right. And if you get something out of order, you mess up the whole thing. In other words, you know all those truths about God's final after-death judgment. Did Solomon? Verse 14 was easy for you. It was very easy because your mind is informed by the New Testament. But if you're thinking in an Ecclesiastes historical framework, this conclusion tackles you and leaves you flat on your back. Look for a moment at chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 14. Chapter 8, verse 14, Solomon writes this, "There is futility which is done on the earth." Here it is. "There are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And on the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility." It's really, really frustrating when that happens. In fact, Solomon spent a good portion of the closing chapters of this book arguing that there is not always a one-to-one correlation in life between your behavior and what you actually get. Sometimes in life, the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. But then Solomon actually said this back in chapter 3. Look at chapter 3, verse 16 and 17. Having said that in chapter 8, that you don't always get what you deserve under the sun, and it's really, really frustrating. And then he said this earlier in the book, though. He said, furthermore, 3:16, "I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. And I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there." You say, wait a minute. He can't have it both ways. In chapter 8, Solomon argues that there is no assurance of evil being punished and good being rewarded in this life. But in chapter 3, and then at the end of chapter 12, he says that evil will absolutely be punished. Well, which is it, Solomon? You can't have it both ways. Solomon understood perfectly the apparent contradiction of these statements. As I said, for our New Testament minds, there was no tension. Whatever you get in this life, we understand everything will be sorted out after death. But where in the Old Testament does it say that God will judge all men after they die? There's clearly life after death. You know, I mean, Enoch went somewhere when God took him in Genesis 5 and kept on living, right? And so there is very much an understanding of life after death in the Old Testament. But where does it say that God will judge all men after they die? The passages you're thinking of are in the New Testament, written 1,000 years after Ecclesiastes. Actually, there is one Old Testament passage that speaks of judgment following death. However, that's found in Daniel 12, verse 2, which was written 400 years after Ecclesiastes. And you say, but surely Solomon meant this to refer to final judgment, didn't he? Yes, of course he did. You say, I'm feeling dizzy right now, help me out. Here's what Solomon's doing, and he's done this all through the book, hasn't he? He is forcing you to think through this like he had to. He just doesn't give you pat answers. He doesn't spell it out for you. He refuses to do that. What he does is he gives you the equation, and then he gives you the numbers, and he says, okay, do the math, figure it out. I'm not going to walk through the formula on the board for you. Here's the formula, here's the numbers, figure it out. He could have spelled it out, but writing it on the whiteboard like a first grade teacher just isn't Solomon's way. As always in this book, he leads you up to a point, and then he leaves you dangling, desperate, forcing you to think through the implications yourself. That's one of the things that makes this book so hard to interpret. So, first he argues that there is no guarantee of wickedness receiving its proper reward under the sun. That little prepositional phrase is pretty important, right? There is no guarantee of wickedness receiving its proper reward under the sun. But in the very last verse, he assures you that every act will be judged. It's brilliant. He leaves you dangling over the abyss of your ignorance, saying, when? Where? When is this going to happen? Solomon smiles, puts down his pen and says, you figure it out. Oh, not again. He pushes you up to the edge. He says, but you're going to have to jump over to the conclusion on the other side. Okay, I've tortured you long enough. Let me walk you through it. Here's what he's doing. Not having prior biblical revelation that specifically talks about a final judgment after death, under the inspiration of the Spirit, Solomon took what he knew to be true about God, God's justice, and what he knew to be true about life, the fact that the wicked sometimes do prosper and they get away with it and life seems to go easy for them. Solomon took those two things and, well, he can put two and two together better than most. He didn't have the specifics that you and I have because God had not revealed them yet. But he knew that there must be something more. That there must be something more, something after this life. He knew that there was life after death. He already talked about it in chapter 3. Sometime, though, there must be a time when God fully applies his perfect justice. There must be. So he doesn't quite say that there is a post-death judgment in verse 14. You were reading that into it. But if you can't see that that's where he's pointing, then you're just not looking. The only thing that can make sense of the evil and the injustices of life are that God will one day set them right. And he will. But you know what? Not even that captures Solomon's brilliant final word completely. There's one more thing that he wants you to think. And again, he will not spell it out for you. But as you work through the whole book, you're left nowhere but with this conclusion to arrive at. Solomon looked ahead with a clearer vision than any other man ever had. And he saw that there must be a final day of judgment. And in that final day of judgment, all of the discord, all of the despair, all of the frustration, all of the futility, all of the meaninglessness, all of the pain and the sorrow and the suffering of this book was suddenly resolved. Like a great composer would take you up on the organ and it's got this, you're at the crescendo and there's this discordance and you're going, and then he resolves it into the perfect chord. Right? That's what Solomon does. If God must and will bring everything to judgment, then here's that phrase we've used it through our study. What that means is what is wrong. That's what judgment means. Not just that you should fear God and keep his commandments because God will have you account or have everyone give an account for their behavior. That's true, but Solomon is going so much farther than that. As you think through this whole book and the fact that there is that there is the travail and the hardness that is associated with Ha-Adam, the man, the Adam, right? You look at that and say, oh, now I'm starting to see. There is this pain and there's this suffering and there's this injustice and there's this evil. What judgment at the end means is that what is wrong. It means that Solomon was supposed to be frustrated. Do you see it? He was supposed to be frustrated with life under the sun. It's that severe mercy. His dismay and his disappointment with life as he saw it around him and with himself it was supposed to be. Why would you be satisfied with a sin-cursed, fallen world? Why did death frustrate him so much in chapter 2? Well, because death is wrong. It's not the way it's supposed to be. I told you this earlier in the series. I don't know about you, but when I go to a funeral, I sit there and a lot of thoughts are in my mind, a jumble of emotions, but you know what? The one that's at the base of them all is, this is wrong. This should not be happening. Death is not right. Why did injustice frustrate Solomon so much in chapters 3 and 4 and 5? Because injustice is wrong. Because evil is wrong. Do you think it's right? Do you think we should be satisfied with this world? Are you crazy? It's wrong. Why is he so frustrated with the brevity and the emptiness of life? Because that's not the way life was meant to be. What tore at Solomon's heart, what ate him up in the inside, that fleeting nature of the few years of our life, and then you die, and the toil and the pain and the sorrow and the suffering and the death, all those things are wrong. They are, this word will surprise you, unnatural. God didn't make the world or you to be that way. It's all because of the fall. It's all because of our stupid sin. You see, that's what, in the context of the whole book, that's what final judgment means. It is here that the agony and the tension of the book resolve. Something is wrong, and God will make it right. The last thought of this book is the deepest, the best, the most profound. To come to the conclusion that there was a final judgment was the greatest relief imaginable for Solomon. What judgment means is that everything that is wrong about this fallen, sinful world that frustrates you and frustrates me as believers in Jesus Christ, everything that frustrates me about me and everything that frustrates you about you, it's wrong. It's bent. And try as we might, and believe me, Solomon tried, try as we might, we can't fix it. We can't fix what the fall is broken. We can't straighten the bent. Judgment means, as Paul said in Romans 8, that there is a time when God will fix it. His futile, groaning, sin-cursed creation redeemed through the powerful work of Jesus Christ on the cross. C.S. Lewis once said this, "There have been times when I think we do not desire heaven. But more often I have found myself wondering whether we have ever desired anything else." That's a profound insight. That's a great way to sum up Ecclesiastes. There are times when I think we do not desire heaven, but more often I find myself wondering whether we have ever desired anything else. What Solomon longed for and what you long for is the great fix when God fixes everything that is broken. That's why you've never been fully and lastingly content. That's why you've never been enduringly satisfied. That's why you will never be permanently fulfilled under the sun. What you want is heaven. You know what? Even unbelievers want that. They just don't know yet. What you want is God. God without mixture. God without sin, without your sin, without my sin, without everyone else's sin. God without pain, without suffering, death, without the curse. And that's why it says in Revelation 22:3, there will be no more curse. It is only when you embrace Ecclesiastes' dissatisfaction with the Genesis 3 world that you truly long for the Revelation 21 and 22 world. Right? Because on that day, in that world, when evil is judged, when everything is judged and sin is banished and Christ reigns, what is will be right for the first time since Genesis 3. It took God's own Son, the second person of the Trinity, dying on the cross, bearing the consequences of all that wrong. But God will make it right. That's what final judgment means. So Solomon's search, it's your search. It ends, the final word, when through Jesus Christ, God becomes your all. It ends when you realize, as Jesus said in John 10:10, I came to give life and life, not Ecclesiastes kind of life, but I came to give life and life, remember what it says? Abundantly. Jesus didn't come to give us Ecclesiastes kind of life. He came to give us perfect life. He came to give us what your heart has always, always longed for. Remember your Creator in the days when you are young. Because you know what? He is an absolutely sure and certain hope. And that's true under the sun, and that's true forever. Lord, we have not longed for you and for your great fix, for the redemption, redeeming work of Jesus Christ applied not only to us, but the whole creation. We have not longed for that enough, Solomon teaches us to. We still live in Ecclesiastes' world. We still live under the fall, and it's hard, it's difficult, it's painful. There is sorrow and death and suffering and injustice. And we look at it all and we say, we know what will carry us through this. Fear God, keep his commandments. As we run to you, you are our strong tower and we will be safe. And Lord, as we look at this life and are frustrated, as we taste the dust of death in our mouth, as everything turns to ashes in our hand, right? As we grow old, eventually, as Solomon has described it in chapter 12, and as we face up to our own death one day, Lord, our eyes look beyond. We look through the empty tomb that Jesus has walked through and out the other side of, and realize that by your grace, we will walk through death as well. Death does not steal meaning. Death is simply the gateway to it, because it is the gateway to you. It is the gateway to the perfect life that you have promised us in Jesus Christ. It is the perfect life. It is the life abundant, the life without curse, the life without the fall, the life where we will be everything that you have made us to be in holiness and perfection. Lord, we should enjoy this life. You give much good. Solomon's made that clear all the way through the book. You give many good gifts to carry us through this life. We're thankful for them. But really, all they are is the tiniest taste of heaven, because that's what our hearts really long for. Not so much a place, but a person, you. And so we would desire, Lord, that we remember you, our Creator, through your beloved Son, by the power of your Spirit, every single day of our life. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.